afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 31st of May, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio is Patrick Henningsen. And we have Alex Thompson joining us from the Netherlands, as usual, for Wednesday. But before we bring Alex onto the programme, we're going to go straight into a little pre-recorded piece of video. On Monday, I was speaking to Anthony Carlin, who, if you remember, was the ex-Police Service Northern Ireland policeman who was fighting Santander over his mortgage. Brian interviewed him about a year ago. I did a short segment with him, and then we're going to bring him on live just to bring you up to date. So let's watch what was recorded on Monday first. So I'd like to welcome Anthony Carlin to the programme. Anthony is the former Police Service Northern Ireland policeman who was interviewed by Brian about 18 months ago. Anthony, welcome to the programme. Just remind us, if you could, what your court case was about and why Brian was interviewing you.
I was a serving police officer, and on my private life, I was getting taken to court with Santander for the repossession of my house. So I basically investigated everything that was going on and found all these discrepancies and things that I wasn't happy with, which to my mind was criminal actions. I put all of those things in front of the judge, including the document which showed that my mortgage had been paid off twice in full by an anonymous third party to Santander, and that they had suppressed that information and failed to inform the court that those payments even took place. So I put everything to the judge and put him on his oath that he had to do certain things to produce certain documents which would prove my innocence in the court, and he failed to do so. So at that point, I arrested him for 5 criminal offences.
And this was related to the securitisation of mortgages, is that right?
Yes, so my mortgage was securitised, and that was somewhere in the mix there. But basically, I arrested the judge because he failed to uphold the law and to do what he was duty-bound to do as a judge. And so when I arrested him, I called for police to come. And when the police arrived, they basically ignored everything I had done, which was a complete breach of the code of ethics of the police, that they have to assist a colleague with an arrest, no matter how unusual. It was for me to document why I arrested him in front of a custody sergeant, but that never happened, which was a breach of pace.
Okay. So that was at that point. You'd ended up in prison for a short time, effectively being railroaded on contempt of court charges, and then we interviewed you. Now, just if anybody wants to see that interview, we're going to play it out immediately after this news program on the live stream. So if you haven't seen that interview with Anthony yet, stick with us and you can watch it on the live stream. Now, Anthony, that was just over a year ago. What's happened since then and where are you at today?
Well, basically, I was dismissed from my job, and I spent the last year basically going through all the appeal process. I spoke to everybody from the policing board themselves, and the police ombudsman, everybody that to do with the justice system in Northern Ireland. I was talking to them and engaging with them, and they all basically pulled rank, and they all said, On the 17th of October, you were sentenced to jail for the loss of justice, so we're not listening to anything you say. That's what's going on for the last year. Bottom line was that I was able to produce a criminal record check from the police to show that I have no criminal convictions whatsoever, which negated all their charges against me, but they still weren't found against me. So I've just came to the end of that process now, where again, the shutters just came down and no one was trying to listen to what I had going to say. So the bottom line is what I found over the past year looking at my case was that I seen judicial corruption being and collusion of the PSNI, the senior PSNI. So there's corruption and collusion going on with the police and with the judiciary, which brings me up to the more recent events that I spoke to you about earlier.
But at the moment they're going for court costs, is that right?
Yes, so what's happened recently is my case is back in court for the trying to repossess my house again. And separate to that, the judge that I arrested has instructed me to give reasons as to why costs shouldn't be given against me for the case in which I arrested him.
Right, so let me understand this. You arrested the judge, you were put into prison for contempt of court around that arrest, you were sacked from your job, but here we are 18 months later and they still haven't taken your house, but they're still trying to take your house.
Yes, very
Right.
much so.
Okay. So they're now going for costs as well. And as a result of all the investigations that you've been carrying out over this period of time, you've discovered something quite disturbing, potentially about the judicial process and particularly about the judge. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. So basically what's happened is people approached me over the last year because I put my head above the parapet and made allegations against the judiciary. Other people have came to me in the meantime saying that they've also suffered at the hand of judicial criminality or corruption. And there's one particular story that was put to me with some evidence. It's called the Freddie Andrews story, and it's covered in detail at www.justbelfast.com.
But this this story has been covered extensively in the mainstream press because this is quite a this is a historic case, right?
Yeah, so it goes back the last 30 years, just since 1976. It's right up until the 70s, 80s, 90s, and noughties. It finished in 2007 was the last input into the website. But that family have just alleged complete corruption by the entire Northern Ireland judiciary, that they stole all of their property by fraud. It's an amazing story. It's one of the most notorious stories ever to come out of Northern Ireland.
Right, so their allegation is that the judiciary was involved in the removal of their property.
Yes,
And
by fraud.
how does this fit with your case then?
Well, I didn't initially see how it did fit in my case. It was just another example of corruption, which I agreed with, but I didn't see that it actually tailored in or came in along with my case until I started looking at it. So what they were saying was there's a house at the centre of that called Tara House, which this family belonged to this family, but the person whose name was on the deeds was Freddie Andrews, and he had the mental age of a 10-year-old due to a botched brain operation that he had as a youngster. So in law, he wouldn't be able to sign documents and to give permissions to people because he didn't have the mental capacity to do it. In order for him to do that, he would need to have people looking after his welfare as well as his legal interests, and that didn't happen. So what did happen was, a corrupt solicitor was a witness to him signing over his property to a senior law society solicitor in Northern Ireland. And that should not have happened in law because the law society solicitor, it was a conflict of interest for someone in the legal profession to benefit from this man. He had been placed in the Royal Courts of Justice as a ward of the court to be protected by the courts. And here we have someone, a senior law society solicitor, buying his house from him and what amounts to fraud because he couldn't assign the property across.
And who was that senior solicitor?
He was Gerald Jeffrey, Gerald Patrick Jeffrey.
Okay, and how does that fit in with your case then?
So what happened was Gerald Patrick Jeffrey, he was the purchaser in that agreement, and the witness was a man called Herbert Wright. Now, Herbert Wright was later the only person to become convicted in relation to the portfolio of the Freddie Andrews estate having been plundered and stolen.
So there
He was.
was so there was w at least one conviction. So there was acknowledgement within the Northern Irish establishment that there had been wrongdoing here.
Yes, but what happened was they stole the property from Freddie Andrews and they were trying to sell it to another third party. And the third party caught on that this wasn't a bona fide transaction and they took the solicitor to court. So it was on behalf of this company that the prosecution came, not the Freddie Andrews family at all, that they've never received justice. What happened was, say, Freddie Andrews sold the property to Gerald de Jeffrey, and the witness was this crooked solicitor. Okay? So Gerald Jeffrey, he held onto the property for 10 years. During that 10 years, the matter was being investigated by a PSN or an RUC officer.
And for those that don't know, the RUC was the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which is the precursor to the Police Service Northern Ireland.
So this officer, he was a very good police officer, and he cooperated and contacted the family on a regular basis, and they trusted him, and they understood that what he was doing was right for them. But what happened was he told members of the press, I think it was the Sunday World, the night before he died, that he was scared for his safety. He was worried about his safety, and the next day he was found on the North Shore in Belfast with his hands tied behind his back and a shot to the back of the head.
But that was suicide.
That was deemed by the coroner in Northern Ireland, who is a judge and who's an arm of the court, to be a suicide. And that's, I mean, everybody at the time kicked up and said they couldn't believe it, but they said it was an elaborate suicide to make the RUC look bad.
Okay, so we've got an investigating police officer shot dead under strange circumstances, claimed to be a suicide. We have a house purchased, held on to for 10 years. What became of the house then?
So then what happened was, after the police officer had been killed, about 8 months after that, then the house was sold by Patrick de Genfrey to another party.
And who was the other party?
The same judge that I arrested last year.
So what you're saying is that the house at the centre of an acknowledged fraud case is now in the hands of the judge who you allege did not handle your case properly, and who you attempted to arrest. In fact, you did arrest, but he was rescued by your colleagues. So that's the same judge.
The exact same judge. I couldn't say, it was a massive shock to me, but this was the information that I was given, and I went and used my PSNI training to investigate this and unearth documents. So I've now come up with two documents for the Freddie Andrews story that have never been seen before, which I've sent over to yourselves.
And that was he a judge when he bought the property?
No, he was the documents here. He was Queen's Counsel. He was a QC.
And in your opinion, could it be that he could not have known that this property that he was buying was linked to this fraud case?
There's no possible way that that's the case, because let's say 8 months before that, the police officer that had been investigated had been shot dead in suspicious circumstances. And then 6 weeks after he bought that, then the solicitor, the corrupt solicitor, he was convicted in court of this later offence. So this was sandwiched in between.
But at the very least, you require this judge to recuse himself. Because it seems, aside from anything else, is it normal that the same judge would continue through a case in the way that this judge is?
Well, I mean, obviously what happened last year was highly unusual. Happened in those circumstances, he maybe would have recused himself anyway, had I asked. But I've asked for him to be recused and for his judgment against me to be overturned, because I don't believe he's a fit and proper person to be sitting as a judge. If you look at it's called the Bangalore Principles and the Judicial Conduct, all the rules to do with how judges must conduct themselves on and off the job. And they can't be seen to be involved in any set of circumstances which even would suggest unbiased or unethical behaviour on behalf of a judge, because it would bring the judiciary into disrepute. And he's done this 1,000 times over. This is on the verge of criminality, if not criminality itself.
Okay, and then just finally, obviously the police officer, the policeman who was investigating the original fraud, ended up losing his life. Are you concerned for your own safety in these circumstances?
I think we're in a different time in Northern Ireland than we were then. But as we've seen there was a shooting in Bangor yesterday. A man was shot dead in Bangor yesterday to do with the troubles in Northern Ireland. So it still goes on. Will it happen? I hope not, and I pray not. And I'm taking precautions, but I wouldn't put anything past them. So that's why I'm coming out and I'm saying everything very publicly. I've got grave concerns, and I want the public at large to know what's actually going on.
Okay, so I'd like to welcome Anthony to the programme now then. Anthony, thanks for joining us. Now, the reason we recorded that on Monday was because you were in court again yesterday, and we didn't exactly know what the outcome of that was going to be. So bring us up to date from what we spoke about on Monday then.
Yes, so I was in front of Madam Justice McBride yesterday, in what amounted to basically a wholly unfair court case where she basically just as I'd went in, she was awarding a possession order to another man before me. Again, she found clearly against the man in favour of the bank, and she wouldn't tell him. He asked simple questions on how he could appeal the case, and she wouldn't give him any guidance or any instructions as what he could do to continue to protect his property.
But that court case yesterday wasn't related to the costs. That's a separate court case. So is this because they're, once again, for the third or fourth time now, trying to seize your property?
Well, yes, they're coming back. It's the second wave of the attack, and there's been numerous cases in relation to it. But in all the 6 years I've been in court, I have never seen a judge display behaviour like she did yesterday. She was highly unfair. She was clearly biased. She was obviously siding with the plaintiff. She interrupted me throughout proceedings and failed to allow me to present my defence in the way that I was comfortable doing. She obstructed me. At one point, she ridiculed me and asked, did I want her to come down and sit beside me in the dock so that she could give me instructions on what to do? It was awful how she treated me.
That continues. When do you hear more about the costs hearing? Because actually there may not be a hearing, is that right?
The cost hearing was a separate matter that's basically curtailed from last year. So the judge that I arrested, I think wisely, decided to deal with it on paper, emails back and forth to the court rather than have another hearing. But I've put in a complaint in relation to him not being a fit and proper person to preside over these proceedings for the reasons in the video. And I've asked for him to be struck off the, or to be recused from the case, and for my case to be overturned, to his judgment.
Now, the case that you mentioned in that little piece that we did there, that did get quite extensive mainstream media coverage over the last 30 years. But there hasn't been much about it in the last 10 years or so. But you're in contact with that family and working with them now, is that right?
Yes, I've got their full permission to put this back into the public domain and to share the Freddie Andrews story, which is the most notorious story in Northern Ireland. But yeah, I've got their full support, yes.
Okay. Well, Anthony, thank you for joining us. Just a short segment, live segment with you. But that brings everybody up to date. And we will deal with the Freddie Andrews case in more detail in the not too distant future. Now, for anybody that wants to find out more about this, as I said in the pre-recorded piece, we will be playing out the Brian's interview with Anthony just straight after this news programme. But also, Anthony, people can find you on your Facebook. Is this a group or a page?
It's just my own personal page. I'm trying to keep my bank fighting activity separate to my family. So I've started a page that anybody can go on to, which is separate from my own profile, you know, just to keep that separate.
Okay, super. There is an event coming up dealing with this issue of fraudulent mortgages. Give us the details on that.
It's basically www.clearyourmortgage.co.uk. It's a group that's coming out now, and effectively they're trying to make securitisation of mortgages the new PPI. So there's an event coming up on the 8th of June that I'm speaking at in central Birmingham. So they can go onto that website. I don't know if you're able to put up the photograph there, but it's clearyourmortgage.co.uk for information.
Yeah, we have a little ad section later on. We'll bring that slide up then.
Yeah.
Okay, Anthony, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be in touch. And as I say, we'll be doing more on the Andrews case as well.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, let's move on then. And Alex, this article from Foreign Affairs magazine, complete change of subject, or perhaps not. World Order 2.0 is the headline, The Case for Sovereign Obligation. And really, of course, at the heart of this article is the issue of rights and obligations. This is by Richard N. Haass. He says that for nearly four centuries since the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War, the concept of sovereignty, the right of nations to an independent existence and autonomy, has occupied the core of what international order there has been. This made sense, for as every century, including the current one, has witnessed, a world in which borders are forcibly violated is a world of instability and conflict. But an approach to international order premised solely on respect for sovereignty, together with the maintenance of balance of power necessary to secure it, is no longer sufficient. The globe's traditional operating system, call it World Order 1.0, has been built around the protection and prerogatives of states. It is increasingly inadequate in today's globalised world. Little now stays local. Just about anyone and anything, from tourists, terrorists and refugees to emails, diseases, dollars and greenhouse gases, can reach almost anywhere. The result is what goes on inside a country can no longer be considered the concern of the country alone. Today, circumstances call for an updated operating system, call it World Order 2.0, that includes not only the rights of sovereign states, but also those states' obligations to others. So what Haas seems to be saying here, Alex, as far as I can see, is that just as we are being told as individuals that we only get our human rights, forget God-given rights, we only get our human rights if we meet our obligations to the state, Haas seems to be saying that states only get their rights of sovereignty if they meet their obligations. And the first question in my mind, Alex, is who are these obligations to?
Well, ultimately, they would be to Haas's own people. If you recall the recent appearance of Mark Anderson of American Free Press, who is the expert on the Bilderberg Group and the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, which is for, on whose behalf Richard Haas writes, the Chicago Club of Globalists, basically, who have an access to London and New York, they regard themselves, the great industrialists of the world or of the West, as the rightful heirs of the planet, the planetary fiefdom, as some people call it, such as Ike. And so Haas is saying, really, just like individuals have been schooled for a couple of generations now in post-libertarian, post-liberty ideas that, you know, we decide when you get your rights, you must live up to your responsibilities or we'll pull the plug on you as an individual, financially or in your health and your food. So the same is being threatened on entire nations now. And it's one of the signs that the Bilderberg Group actually is on the back foot now. There's a number of indications of that. Besides this this piece, which sounds ominous, but is actually the Bilderbergers showing that they're quietly desperate, we have more examples of that. For example, if you go to that AmericanFreePress.net site, Mark Anderson's site, he does a brilliant interview with Daniel Estulin. If you just look for New Movie Exposes Bilderberg on AmericanFreePress.net, you'll find it. Listen very carefully to this high-level interview because Estulin, who together with Anderson is the expert on Bilderberg in the free media, they're saying, well, actually, these old money guys in Europe are panicking. They have wrecked two financial and economic systems since the Peace of Westphalia. If you want to know what that is, look at the British Constitution Group talk I gave in Winchester. And because of this sovereign system of states, the money men have not had unfettered global access, and they very much dearly wish to have it because their own model is burned out, at least in the Western economies. And they're wanting desperately to persuade the rest of the world, the developing world, to join their system, but no one's being persuaded. So there seems to be several indications of wrestling going on within the global elite or the Western elite as to what model to pursue, which is a good sign. They're not all on the same side. There's division among them.
Well, indeed. So, look, let's remind ourselves what the first clause of the Peace of Westphalia said, because this really was the basis of modern nation states. That there should be a Christian and universal peace and a perpetual, true and sincere amity, that this peace and amity be observed and cultivated with such sincerity and zeal that each party shall endeavour to procure the benefit, honour and advantage of the other, and thus that on all sides they may see a peace, see this peace and friendship flourish by entertaining a good and faithful neighbourhood. And Alex, that always seemed like a pretty good basis for a foreign policy to me.
Absolutely, it worked extremely well, and it capped off a period of centuries of internecine strife in Europe. And Patrick's in the studio today. The very nation of the United States could never have been formed without the Peace of Westphalia, because it allowed the best of Europeans to cooperate and compete on a friendly basis, peaceful basis, both in Europe and in the New World. And without that idea, great nations and economies would not have been formed since that period. But of course, it's not in the interest of the peak people, whether you call them capitalists or decry them more specifically as corporatists or whatever, it's not in their interests for us all to be free and prosperous.
I wanted to sort of compare what the Peace of Westphalia says with what President Xi Jinping said a couple of years ago. History tells us that the law of the jungle isn't the way of human coexistence. Every nation should obey the principle of equality, mutual trust, learning from each other, cooperating and seeking joint benefits for the construction of a harmonious world, sustained peace and joint prosperity. And it seemed to me at that time that he was absolutely echoing the sentiments of the Peace of Westphalia. Is this that in your view, and I'm going to ask Patrick the same question, is this that she is has a genuinely different view of how the world should work compared to the Bilderberg types, these Western internationalists? Or is he just couching the same globalization in different language?
Well, the communist Chinese are not to be trusted in the end. Our forefathers of the Cold War were quite right about that. There is some kind of Eurasian alliance developing. It has various acronyms, the Collective Shanghai Treaty Organization, the Eurasian Economic Community and so on. But the Russians and Chinese are not easy bedfellows, let alone when you try to stick the Germans in. They're all at each other's throats. They have incompatible worldviews. And besides that, the communist Chinese have been a laboratory for Western Marxism to test out the kind of total population control online and in the economy that they wish to unleash on the West, particularly driven by the Washington State Department and the London think tanks. So Xi is not to be trusted, but he is riding a wave, as Putin is in Russia and Merkel even in Germany now, a wave of sentiment in these great Eurasian countries, which is it's time to be done with Anglo-Saxon hegemony and forge our own model. And part of that, as Bernice Bartels is writing both on our own website and also at her own blogspot at Global Citizen News, if you look for her recent piece on that, which is called New Digital ID and Gold on the Blockchain, she's pointing out that all the gold is held in the East, and now all the Western elites can do is invent blockchain technology driven by people like Blythe Masters, the woman who arguably ruined the economy with her credit default swap ideas. She's very big on blockchains. All these people are basically desperately trying to hold the reins of the Eurasian economy by saying, okay, well, we'll at least, we don't have any gold anymore in our vaults, but we'll at least administer it on computers for you. So that there's a very complicated power play going on, but all the cards are in the East's hands because the precious metals and the productivity is there.
Do you have any thoughts on this?
I just go back to the original article which started this conversation by Richard Haass from the Council on Foreign Relations. The two reasons that he gave to discredit his case, to discredit the modern nation state, were the borders being violated, nation state borders being violated. And the other was, he mentioned greenhouse gases, which was a sort of a look into global governance, a la the COP21 or the Paris Climate Agreement, that sort of global governance idea. And so that's, you know, the whole idea, firstly, of greenhouse gases is very debatable in scientific circles, okay? So that's the one. But violating borders of nation states, who is the most egregious violator of borders of nation states? They have to be NATO member states. Look at what Turkey did in Syria recently. Look at the United States has effectively also invaded Syria, a number of other countries. Look at Libya. Look at so many other examples. So the biggest violator of other people's borders in a violent fashion are NATO member states led by the United States. And this is where Richard Haass is from. He served in those administrations. So how is he to lecture anybody? And so, again, the U.S. and is leading the problem creation. And so then they manage the reaction, and here he's providing the solution. Hmm. So, you know, a thesis, antithesis.
Yeah.
So there we are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to apologize to Anthony for not having this slide in the right order, but this is the event that he was talking about, the Mortgage Compensation Seminar. Go to SimEvents, CYMEVENTS.co.uk for details on that. 8th of June, 6 to 7 p.m. in Birmingham, five ways. So that's that. And then 11th of June at 7 p.m. in the Cheese and Grain in Froome, you, Vanessa, Peter.
Peter Ford.
Ford, thank you. Yeah. Apologies, Peter. Robert Stewart, Professor Piers Robinson, Professor Tim Hayward speaking at that event. Do get along to it if you can. Right. Now, Spiegel, Alex, I'm kind of dropping this on you because you may not have seen this, but Spiegel Online has published this article, It's Time to Get Rid of Donald Trump. They're basically, well, I mean, how do you read this headline, Patrick?
Well, they're inferring assassination, I guess.
Absolutely.
That's not the first time.
That's right. So we've got to get rid of him. They're saying that he's a danger to the world. One of the media's tasks is to continue telling things as they are. Trump has to be removed from the White House quickly. He is a danger to the world. Why? Other than a string of personal insults, Trump's crime is that he doesn't play ball. So nothing is regulated, nothing is stable, and the transatlantic relationship hardly exists anymore.
Total hysteria.
Total hysteria.
Yeah, just liberal hysteria completely on steroids.
Alex, I mean, is this typical of Spiegel?
Spiegel gets pretty outrageous at times, it has to be said. It's the flagship of the, what could we call it, triumphalist lefty media that's dominated Germany since the war. But again, whether we see German plots everywhere or not, and there are such things, because the Germans are an impetuous lot, there's always Anglo-American scheming behind them. You can't give the Germans all the blame. And particularly the Germans' natural tendency, which they're well aware of by now, actually, to go hell for leather on things and to try to foist their export goods on people, much like the Chinese do. That tendency tends to be held in check by the better Germans themselves. They're always wrestling with their own demons. And that's a line that was used actually on a crosstalk half-hour episode on RT, which I'd warmly recommend, which appeared just yesterday, I believe, in which Ralph Niemeyer, this independent left-wing German thinker of great moral integrity, pointed this out, actually. It has to do with the obsolescence of NATO, in which he says, you know, the Germans are quite right to say, the Germans point out, rather, that Trump's quite right to say, no, so NATO is obsolete. But why did he have such a slanging match, Trump, with Mrs. Merkel at the G7? Well, we're having to read the runes here, but it looks very much like Merkel said, we must have a strong European military, and Trump's with her on that, of course. He just hears the dollar signs, doesn't he? The dollar bill's ringing up, you know, you pay your dues, because he's not into the geopolitics of it. But what she means, of course, is we must have that to continue to foist our goods on Africa and Russia, you know, a kind of gunboat diplomacy, again, like the Chinese. And it's the Germans and other Germanic continental countries like to ride on the coattails of more gung-ho countries like Britain and America, usually, but they very much enjoy the cover. And now we're backing away from them, both Trump and Britain, America and Britain with Trump and Brexit, at least the popular mood is. The Germans are having to co-opt the entire European army, which you're going to cover later in the programme. So that's what's behind this, that the dominant note in the German elite is very hacked off with Trump for having to make them, against their own inclinations, bare their own teeth and say, OK, we're actually going to be German hegemons now. I mean, a Dutch newspaper this week said that if there was any lingering doubt as to who was top of the monkey pride in Europe, Mrs. Merkel, with her post-G7 speech, has shown that she's top gorilla. You know, that's the kind of thinking that even the Dutch and the Danes have realised now.
That's pretty good language. Okay, well, let's move on to Syria then. And Sergei Lavrov here, according to TASS, well, the headline in TASS is Moscow concerned over US threats against Syrian armed forces. Well, what did he actually say? He said, I believe this situation is rather alarming as it directly affects Syria's sovereignty. Certainly these issues need to be solved, and our troops are doing this now. So, of course, they're talking about the issue of ISIS in Syria and so on. He said that the effort to deconflict and the discussions with the US regarding that are now there are discussions going on over that, but it's not enough. And he said, but of course the effort would be much more efficient if, in addition to that channel of communications, which is rather limited agenda, the US agreed to join the work in coordinating parameters of de-escalation zones. We're ready to welcome the United States joining not only the attempts to avoid incidents, but also to work to define de-escalation zones further. So again, Lavrov offering something to the United States, and the United States not really seeming to want to play ball.
Yeah, this is simple, actually basic political 101 tactics. You could probably even read it in Saul Alinsky's book. He's forcing the other side to live up to their standards of diplomacy or their standards of international moral norms, as it were, and cooperation and international law, all the things that the United States and its allies, including the UK and France, have been routinely flouting since the beginning of the Syrian war. So, I mean, Russia's just playing it by the book, Mike. Mm-hmm. You know what? If you look back, that's all they've been doing pretty much since the beginning of this conflict in Syria. They have absolutely played it by the book. And the other side has been cheating, scheming, breaking, disrupting, undermining, and sabotaging. So what more can we say?
Well, indeed. And as Lavrov pointed out, they are the only ones dealing with the issue of ISIS in Syria at the moment. Here's another example. So they have announced that a warship and a submarine fired cruise missiles at Islamic State, not at Syrian infrastructure, not at Syrian army, just at ISIS.
Not schools and hospitals.
Not schools and hospitals, absolutely. This has apparently hit targets close to Palmyra, and that seems to be the main area of activity at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, strategically, Palmyra is like the hub just south of Deir ez-Zor. It's where strategically so many things are coming together, and obviously this is a good place to break ISIS. Vice versa, for those who are supporting ISIS, Palmyra is a good place to break Syria and to break Syria's military coalition with Russia.
Okay, let's move on to Manchester. Alex, Peter Hitchens, this is from a few days ago now, but he's saying, put away your pointless troops, Prime Minister. Only beat bobbies can stop terror.
Yes, it's one of those Emperor's New Clothes moments, isn't it, when a grand old man of British journalism who's been through all the parties and got jaded with all of them says, but why do we have troops in camouflage meant to protect them in forests on the streets of London? Mm-hmm. What possible military purpose does that serve, or security aim? None at all. It's this morning the Scottish Review launched its weekly update, and you have Kenneth Roy there, who used to be BBC Scotland's front man. On the news, saying that the politicians want us in a state of fear and alarm. Another one of his junior writers saying that the British press is fostering a culture of terror. And Hitchens has realised this. He's saying, well, if you don't have policemen on patrol, you will not spot the early signs of radicalisation and weapons or of bomb-making. What can a man or woman with an SA-80 in forest camouflage do in Westminster?
Yeah.
Really just mop up the pieces.
Absolutely.
A lot of people have been saying this in America too, Mike. It's a law enforcement issue. I'm sorry, any way you cut it. A crime is a crime, whether it's terrorism, murder, or theft in any country. And the people best suited to deal with crime are law enforcement, police, frontline civil constables, and so forth.
This is
common sense.
This is absolutely correct. But of course, let me just remind where this has come from. This policy, to my knowledge, the first time I saw this policy openly discussed, this policy of merging civilian and military infrastructures, was from Federica Mogherini at the European Defence Agency conference in November 2015. She was absolutely calling for that. We've covered this several times. Subsequently, as news came out, for example, NATO deploying non-lethal weapons to NATO staff, and you've got to ask, well, what kind of role are NATO going to be fulfilling if they're receiving so-called non-lethal weapons, rubber bullets and so on, right?
Policing.
A policing role. So between NATO and the European Union, we're seeing this move to merge these two forms of institution. And as you've pointed out a couple of days ago, of course, on the European continent, they have a much more of a militarized structure, but it's still civilian police. Even if it's a militarized civilian police, it's still civilian police. What's going on here? What was demonstrated following Manchester was something quite different, where military personnel were being put under the command and control of Crusader Dick. I mean, come on. So that's the situation. That's somewhat different and particularly dangerous and worrying. Now, they've pulled back from that now, but they've now set the precedent.
It's all predicated on the idea that the police just can't handle it. It's too much. So they put out fake statistics like we are looking at X amount of 23,000 terrorists running amok in Britain. You know, so inflated statistics based on sort of hyperbole. And so what are the real numbers? Well, ask the police what the real numbers are, and I think you'll find they're much lower in terms of specifics.
Alex, do you have any thoughts on why Mogherini and Stoltenberg are pushing this policy of merging civilian and military institutions?
You could take the line of saying that it's a means of just keeping the population cowed, but it also allows for blurring of funding, as in the United States, actually, and the United States aid to foreign militaries, where there are rules about what the Pentagon can do to train foreigners and what the US police or other law enforcers can do. It allows, if there's one type of person, like a military person under police command or vice versa, you've got sufficient blurring to be able to send anyone on any operations anywhere, and for temporary and extraordinary help, as with NATO Article 5, although that tends to refer to airframes and so on, but the same concept, you can draft people in so that eventually you're being soldiered by Romanians on the streets of London as a temporary measure.
Yeah,
it's a way, because it's done by a treaty, it's a way of circumventing our standing requirements and our constitutional and statutory limitations.
Okay, well, sticking with Manchester, we've got this headline from the Metro. Survivor of 7/7 found dead after Manchester bombing because he didn't want to live in a world of terror attacks. Both you and Patrick asked for this to be put in. Alex, so let me hear your thoughts on the story first.
Poor Tony Walter, who was 52 when he took his own life, he was often called the most outspoken, at least in his testimony, in the 2005 inquest. He was the most outspoken of the survivors. And Nick Collerstrom in Terror on the Tube picked up on the fact that he very honestly testified that being bombed, apparently by a chap using a shrapnel rucksack device, that the feeling of being subjected to this was like being, quote, electrocuted from the feet up. One of several indications that not the only thing going on there was a bomb at waist height going off from a rucksack. I mean, I was inside, as it were, on the inside at the time, covering these very attacks and the response to them. And for months, I was only seeing the footage that MI5 wanted me to see of that, really, and not finding out about what the survivors had said. And I think one of the elements in this may have been the poor man's realization that, as well as the very real Islamist extremist wave that caused the attacks, there was a lot of connivance, at the very least, going on.
Patrick?
Sure. When I saw this story, I thought, wow, how bizarre. So the story claims that the person committed suicide hours after the attack. So this would have been on the evening, Monday evening, or, you know, early in the morning on Tuesday, because he just couldn't bear to live anymore in a world of terrorist attacks. And they specifically said this Westminster had set him off, and then this had finished him off in Manchester. And you go in and says the article in The Independent ran the Mirror story. So this was basically syndicated through a number of mainstream outlets and said, friends say, his friends claim. And you go and read a little closer, and I thought, where did this story come from? And I trace it back, and it turns out it originated in The Sun. So an unnamed friend, singular friend, told The Sun that he committed suicide because it reminded him of 7/7 Manchester. All that's happening within a period of hours, okay? Because you have to remember, the Manchester was late at night when this story came. So if it was hours after the Manchester attack, then his friend, unnamed friend, would have had to know that he was going to top himself because of Manchester within those few hours. And it's an unnamed friend. So why are they saying friends say, plural, and then you find out they don't even name the person who gave this information to The Sun? It just seems to me like a tabloid story, Mike, that quite possibly, like many stories, let's be honest, many stories in tabloids that are inflated and misleading, and in some cases could be classed as disinformation and fake news. Okay, I'm not saying that I know that this is fake news, but I am saying that it looks, this story has been respun by The Independent. And, you know, look at The Independent, it doesn't even have a newspaper anymore. It's basically an online blog, which is masquerading as a news outlet now. And so they've respun something out of The Sun. This is where The Independent is as a news organization.
Yeah.
And so I just say people should ask questions about the stuff they're reading in the paper. I personally don't think this story is watertight. I think I have questions about this story.
And, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And Alex the Duran, and how the British deep state turned Manchester into Al-Qaeda town, UK?
Well, the areas just south of Manchester city centre, which were of concern with the Libyans coming in, are the same parts, Longsight and the like, just south of Mossai, just south of the Black Yardi gang areas, basically. These Arab Libyan areas were the same ones that we were watching around the time after 9/11 and after 7/7, and all the things in between, like the supposed Raisin plot. So there's a kind of safe neighbourhood there where we were. As a state, particularly, I think elements of the security services were fostering these chaps. For example, in this case, it's the LIFG, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. We were long opposed to Gaddafi, kind of tribal Berbers. And it's just the same with the long-term plan to take down Iran. There's been a very high interest by Israel and the West in supporting Mujahideen al-Khalq, which is an anti-Tehran or anti-Shia regime group. And the kinds of intelligence that we have been producing on these guys for decades, or the people who are interested in consuming that intelligence, are a very different group of people than would be interested in looking at the threat from Al-Qaeda, for example. They seem to have been keeping a watching brief on these tame terrorists for decades. And in that article there in the Duran, one Ziad Hashim says, when the Libyan revolution started, that's the revolution which deposed Gaddafi and ended with him being killed in horrible ways. Hashim says, things changed then in Britain. Their way there, he means the authorities, their way of speaking to me and treating me was different. They offered to give me benefits, even ILR, indefinite leave to remain, or citizenship. And of course, the article finishes by saying Gaddafi warned that après moi le déluge, you know, all these blackened and Arab terrorists would come into Britain and Europe through that route, both the smuggling and the ideological support. And it happened.
When I was looking at the, because obviously there were these allegations that MI6 was involved with this Libyan group and the family of the young man that is alleged to have done this thing in Manchester. When I was looking into that, Alex, and looking at historic newspaper reports on this, for example, I think it was The Guardian in 2011 carried something where there was an absolutely definitive denial from the British government that MI6 and this Libyan group were in any way linked. I'm not aware that this is something that, as a matter of course, the government does. I assume that on intelligence issues, they simply did not comment. And therefore, a denial, an outright denial, is something unusual, and perhaps we should take note of that.
You're absolutely right there, Mike. The usual policy is NCND, neither confirm nor deny. That wording is often used. We neither confirm nor deny special forces operations, GCHQ operations, for example. For it to be pointed and say a specific no, well, a specific denial is a general admission. That's what is being got at by the question happened. But if you add some adverbial clauses in, for example, Colonel Mustard did not kill her with the candlestick in the dining room, then you're only denying one specific combination of allegations and not the general thrust of what's being advised. And this seems to be not just a British problem with rogue elements in the security services, but also our continental allies. A viewer from southern Sweden has sent me something from SVT Nyheter today, in which an inquiry by the remaining sort of non-far-left outfits in Sweden and Denmark, Sveriges Radio, Danmarks Radio, and Jyllandsposten, the famous newspaper in Jutland, they have found that Sweden and Denmark have been swindled out of the equivalent of 9 or 10 million euros or pounds in crowns in those currency, the equivalent, by VAT fraud, often involving electronic goods sales, the usual carousel, or by fake businesses that went bust. And under the noses of the most stringent and highly taxing regimes in the world, let alone in Europe, Sweden and Denmark have apparently let this happen. These are the same countries which, together with Britain and the Netherlands, have bunged money hand over fist to the White Helmets. The point was that this VAT fraud has gone to benefit ISIS. So a lot of this is going on.
Yeah. Paddy Ashdown then is in the news, Guardian and others covering this. Paddy Ashdown, horrified by parallels between UK and 1930s Germany. Let's see what he had to say. We are the only advanced democracy in the world in which the leader of our nation can get away with not turning up to have a proper debate with the opposition. I think it's extraordinary that we don't seem to be kicking up a fuss about it. But was he merely talking about the fact that there isn't a proper television debate over the election, or was he referring to the pretty draconian security implications following Manchester?
One would hope the latter, Mike, if he's got any libertarian, or I shouldn't use that word narrowly, if he's got any sentiments for liberty and the rule of law. But despite his military background and often avowed patriotism, he's got other interests, as your credits on screen said there, with being basically Viceroy of Kosovo. And so I don't really trust what he's saying. He seemed to enjoy it when his Liberal Democrat Party was the minor party in the coalition in the last parliament up to 2015, and there was no accountability there given either. I think he's just miffed that in marginal Tory Lib Dem constituencies, his people are not going to get a go. And particularly at party leadership level, his beloved Tim Farron isn't going to have a ding-dong with Theresa May, in which, I mean, even the weak Tim Farron would probably outperform May because she's such a wooden performer. But this is one of the aspects of our non-election which rather confuses people. There is no debate and there's no leadership.
Yeah, I might add that Paddy Ashdown's party, if it wasn't for the Liberal Democrats, that this party in power now would not be in power probably.
Yeah.
So maybe he's just trying to make up for that original sin, as it were.
Quite possibly, right. Okay, well, look, Alex, as usual, we're rapidly running out of time, so let's see if we can get through a couple of this. Netherlands doesn't have a government at the moment, is that correct?
That's right. In Belgium, they've gone almost a year before or longer in two periods in the 90s and recently without a government. But that's because of squabbles between the French and Dutch speakers, largely over the budget and so on. But here, the Netherlands always has some time to thrash out a coalition because they have two or three versions of every kind of party, two or three Tory parties, two or three Labour parties, two or three Green parties, two or three Lib Dem parties. And all of these have to get together. But the signs are that there's a complete impasse here. The equivalent of the Lib Dems, D66, are so anti-Christian, they won't have any party party and coalition that has Christian in its name. And the suggestion by the lady you just had on screen, Mrs. Schippers, who's trying to form a government, at least by negotiating in the continental model, she has now submitted a report to the king suggesting that a has-been old senator from the Labour Party called Chink Willink should be appointed the new formateur, as they call him, to form the government, which has gone down very hard with most parties because the Labour Party hemorrhaged down to 9 seats in Parliament. So it's a reward for bad performance, really, jobs for the boys. And there's a desperate attempt to keep the conservative, Christian and any kind of constitutionalist element out of government.
So we now know that while Parliament is dissolved in this country, government still exists, and the Prime Minister and the Ministers of State maintain those positions, even though they're no longer MPs. How does that work in Holland? Or is it just all handed over to the civil service to maintain things running?
No, it's done more formally even than in the British model. The French and every country whose government's based on the French, including Benelux, have a word for this. They call the ministers in that situation démissionnaire. So they have been demissioned, but they still have their old brief. So they continue to run their departments. And that can go on for over a year in the case of Belgium. So there will be government without parliamentary... Well, we have parliamentary scrutiny because Parliament's convened here in the Netherlands again. But what you don't have is a regular cabinet to hold the ministers to account, or the departments. So if a particular ministry wants to fund white helmet type activity, or hand over a couple of battalions to the Germans, or other things that we seem to do a lot in the Netherlands, then there's no accountability.
I see, right. So, right, that's very interesting. Okay, and in, what's going on in Germany then?
The French business paper Les Echos has had a series of articles on how pro-German Macron's people are, because they regard Germany as the motor of European economy, and now they're dischuffed with Britain, which they used to call the free market model to follow. So a lot of the individuals named in this report who are new ministers are pro-German, speak German, follow German models. Apparently they're ready to take German orders. There's a particular push to make an energy union on the Franco-German axis, the next stage beyond the military union. And that seems to be a flagship policy that Macron's ministers are going to implement to tie France even more closely into Germany than the coal and steel pact did.
But Poland, it seems, isn't quite so willing to take on this German authority. So what's Beata saying?
Beata Szydło appeared to speak in the Polish parliament the same on a motion of no confidence, which the opposition who want to see limitless immigration effectively. They had served a motion of no confidence in the Polish defence minister from Beata's party, PiS, Law and Security, Law and Justice, I beg your pardon, because they didn't like the way that the defence minister was doing his job properly. So as you see here, she's getting a standing ovation when she's saying, well, we're never going to compromise on the security of Polish children. We're never going to have terrorist incidents routine in Poland. And as she's saying at this point, she's saying to the opposition, if you can't see that allowing unfettered immigration and deliberately not checking the immigrants is a problem, then you are in fact an ally of those who are causing the terror, which is a point which could well be made in Western Europe. You know, she says you're walking hand in hand, as the subtitle is about to say, with those who are actually committing the terrorist offence. Now, at this point, she got heckled by the opposition, cries of shame, shame. But she also got people, not just her own party either, but anyone who's not a far Marxist, saying, yes, this is absolutely right.
Okay, well, let's move on then to EU military. And this is the Centre for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, which is a Washington-based think tank, complaining bitterly that Britain's military has been cut, that it would struggle to sustain more than 6,500 troops in a future conflict. But of course, what the report doesn't do is explain why this has happened. So I just wanted to briefly remind everybody to keep an eye on this page, the EU military unification page on the UK column website. We have a timeline of EU military unification. EU military unification is the reason why Britain's military is being cut in the way that it is, because if you look at, we've said this before, if you look at the various strategic defence reviews, they are developed in such a way that the interdependence between national militaries all fits together on an EU level. So keep an eye on that. The timeline will be updated as new events new events take place, and please share this as much as possible, because you can't really understand what's going on with the cuts to the British military unless you understand EU military unification. Patrick, we've got a few minutes. Let's talk about AI.
Let's talk about Stephen Fry and okay. AI. Those two terms that you don't normally see.
Are they synonymous?
You don't normally see them next to each other, but some people believe that Stephen Fry is AI. But so this is an article by the Daily Mail, a paragon of news and journalism by many people's standards, allegedly. But so Stephen Fry says in this Daily Mail article, we must prepare for the advances of AI, artificial intelligence. And so Stephen Fry has warned that we should prepare for a dystopian nightmare of an existence. Somehow we're not ready for this. I can't think of any more of a dystopian nightmare, Mike, than seeing the tweets of Stephen Fry fly off Twitter by every few seconds. But anyway, so he criticizes technophobes and politicians for being too slow to the advances of technology, etc. This is a sort of trope. You have to imagine him talking to the Hay Festival somewhere in Wales, talking to all these Guardian editors and left-wing intelligentsia when he's giving this great sort of eulogy for the internet. Anyway, so his remarks came the same week Facebook was accused of dragging their feet for the circulation of what they call sick videos and terror manuals on the website. So basically, if we advance a little further in this story, and we find out that this isn't just a news story about Stephen Fry warning us about AI. We dig a little deeper, and we find that this is actually this article morphs into a promotion for the Conservative Manifesto. This is amazing. So Theresa May called on technology firms to realize that they have a social responsibility to remove harmful content from the internet. And so the Conservative Manifesto vows to crack down on social media, crack down on sites to protect the vulnerable and give people confidence to use the internet without fear of abuse. And bullying and criminality and all these things. So they've used Stephen Fry, and this is the point of this I'm showing, Mike. This is a Daily Mail article. So they've used Stephen Fry as the bait, and it draws people in. And then what do they lead them to? Down a conservative Tory cul-de-sac campaigning. So this is the Daily Mail campaigning for the Conservative Party, for Theresa May, using Stephen Fry as the bait, but decrying the horrors of a free internet. Mm. And this is the Daily Mail that makes most of its income off smut, which lives on the right-hand column of nude photographs, nude selfies. Just type in nude selfie Daily Mail into Google and see how many results come up. And tell me how many days you're going to spend looking at all those articles. And that's how the Daily Mail makes their money. So they're hardly in a position to be lecturing or printing anything, lecturing about what's harmful content for the internet or how the internet should be regulated or how they should sort of clamp down on bloggers and things like this. Mm. So you can see how the cartel is formed here, Mike. Celebrity, high-level politics, and mainstream media all colluding together to create a narrative to basically bring us into the new brave new world.
But it's the Tories that want to bring us into that brave new world. I'm not hearing too much from the Labour Party at the moment about this type of crackdown. This, not to the degree that we're seeing from the Tories, this type of censorship, because that's what it is.
We said after the in post-Manchester, the agenda will be an increase of the police state, a reduction of rights and an expectation of privacy, and an rhetoric about an increase of military operations overseas and to supposedly fight ISIS. And so this Daily Mail article is just basically proving one of those three legs that we said last week.
And the key point here is, of course, Facebook and Twitter are accused of dragging their heels on ISIS content. But as we pointed out yesterday, ISIS content seems to be protected, whereas alternative media, independent media content mm-hmm. seems to be being removed at ever greater amounts.
Sure.
What could be the explanation for that?
Well, this is a collusion between the highest levels of corporate media, the highest levels of politics, and Silicon Valley, basically. The people who own Facebook, who own Twitter, these corporations. They're colluding to control the narrative of everything in the news cycle, essentially, policing it themselves, telling us what's right, what's wrong. So I'm not advocating protecting ISIS content online, but let me say ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been having a field day since 2011 all over social media and recruiting people, thousands of fighters through social media openly, preaching hate openly against anybody who's not like them and advocating for, you know, murder, essentially, mass murder and genocide. Mm-hmm. So that's what our friends in the Silicon Valley have enabled over the last 6 years.
Okay, thank you. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much to Patrick Henningsen. Thank you, Alex Thompson. Thank you for watching. We'll be back, as usual, at 1 p.m. tomorrow. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.